All right, we're on, we're live. Hey, y'all, and by that I mean, rather, hey you, and welcome to another That Chapter podcast. Yep, you better believe it. My name is Mike, and today, folks, I got a couple of stories for you. You know, there's like something about national parks, isn't there? Like, something, you know, kind of spooky, to be frank. All that wilderness, it's like space or something, you know, no one can hear you scream. It is a place, you know, where man, he can be one with nature. And by that, no, I don't mean like smashing outdoors. I mean literally one with nature when you end up inside a wolf's belly. Like, there is scary stuff out there. Okay, let's list them. You got the elements. You got, you know, my tummy rumbling. You got bears. You got wolves. You got psycho hillbilly killers and finger guns. Worst of all, my mortal enemy, the Sasquatch. I'm coming for you, Sasquatch. I think it's things like, you know, the missing 411, which, I mean, honestly, it was kind of bullshit. But that adds to this, like, you know, supernatural creepiness. But, you know, this is what I always think is like, hey, isn't it more fun to believe, like, this paranormal shite is real? You know, there's something primal about telling stories around a campfire, you know, spooky tales. Go back 10,000 years, your great-great-granddaddy times a million was doing that, you know, out in the woods, around a campfire, telling, you know, scary stories so the kids wouldn't run off in the middle of the night. Or more accurately, I suppose, what they would tell kids would be... Well, in this old podcast, my friends, you don't need no paranormal shite. I've got two stories for you about real killers that were out there in them woods. Let's give it a go. First off, let me take you to a place in not western, no, eastern Idaho, not far from Noisy Boise, to a little old place called Caldwell. And there, right on the northern side of town, in like the last kind of few neighborhoods before it is pure farmland and rolling hills, lies a little, an itty-bitty one-story house. Now, the houses there in that location, they all have like a fair bit of land around them. They're not like built on top of each other. It's relatively wooded, but, you know, mainly a lot of, like, small farms. And when I say small farms, I mean, like, people with a couple of chickens. Like, not, you know, not a whole lot of grazing out there. This, it's in Canyon County. And boy, oh boy, were some people extremely, extremely excited to be moving into that particular house in the summer of 2017. It was certainly a super happy time during those days. And super happy, you know, during those long summer days was Nadia and Peyton Medley. Nadia was Peyton's mother. She was 47 years old and she looked it, but she seemed, you know, a nice, friendly woman. Nadia, now, she was actually born in Deutschland and her family still lives there to this day, but Nadia moved to Utah as a youth. And she'd remained, you know, in that general Utah, Idaho area ever since. And she was all about her 14-year-old daughter, Peyton. Peyton, you know, lovely, smiley teen, a little on the heavy side. And she herself was born in Utah. They were together always, an extremely close, like, mother-daughter relationship. Close because... Well, see, Nadia, she didn't always have it easy. She was a widow. Peyton's father and Nadia's husband, Todd Medley, he had passed away from a heart attack 3 years before our story takes place. Our story takes place in 2017 CE. That's, you know, the common era, but you can really use whatever calendar you like. So Todd Medley passed away in 2014. Nadia and Todd, together, they had ran a pet store in the city of Ogden, Utah, before his passing. See, that's one thing that's kind of important about the Medleys. Nadia and Peyton, they loved animals, dogs, cats, a snake. They loved being around them. In fact, that was another reason why they were so excited. Nadia and Peyton were so excited to be moving to this house in Caldwell is that, you know, they had so much room. They were planning on getting some farm animals too. Maybe some chickies, a horse, a goat, ? But Nadia and Peyton, they weren't moving, you know, out to that remote house alone. See, this entire move from Ogden to Caldwell, that was orchestrated by the new man in Nadia and Peyton's life. That man was Mike Bullinger. Mike Bullinger was 60 years of age, a commercial pilot by occupation. He was a heavy-set man, thick, short, graying hair, and a happy, kind face for the most part. Seemed like a, you know, grand lad. He's the kind of guy who walks around going, all the time. He had recently gotten a job flying out of Boise, and so he purchased this home in Caldwell, you know, not far away, for himself, his new girlfriend, well, not really that new. You know, they'd been together for a couple of years, his girlfriend, let's just say Nadia, and her daughter Peyton. Mike, he said he'd grown up in the church, but he was now a non-believer. Nadia, she was a pretty strong atheist herself. Like, if you go on her Facebook, it's kind of, she posts about it a lot. And he had told her he had been divorced for about 10 years, you know, when they got together. So Mike, he had been dating Nadia for about 2 years by this point in 2017. They'd gotten together about a year after her husband passed away. They had actually met when he walked into her place of work, Old World Massage. That's like where she ended up after her husband died. She couldn't run the pet store alone without Todd. So I guess she thought to herself, you know, I like petting dogs. Why not pet humans? So I guess when Mike, he walked into that massage parlor, he got the happy ending he wasn't expecting. They hit it off, and he laid on some of that Mike charm, and they were mad about each other. He had swept her off her feet, and not only that, Peyton too. She adored Mike. She even called him Dad. That's how close they were. Friends of the Medleys, Nadia and Peyton's friends, they would say he was a nice, calm, pleasant man, you know, generous with his time and with what he had. Now, as a pilot, he would have to spend days away from them often enough, sometimes even weeks away from the Medleys, flying around the country. But when he was there 100%. You know, you again can go on their Facebook. They have loads of home footage, right? Out together, the three of them out together at football games, in diners, and in all the footage, they're joking, they're laughing together, happy out, just having a great time.
That sounds so wrong.
Yeah. And you know what's going to happen.
Well, it's going to happen here or what?
He would also show young Peyton how to shoot a gun.
Seriously, just cool. Get a good grip on it. There you go. Other hand, support that hand just like that. Cock the trigger, put your finger in the trigger guard and shoot it, okay? Aim at the target. Don't think about it, just pull the trigger.
And so when Mike asked Nadia and Peyton to move in with him to a property he had just purchased outside Boise, that property in Caldwell, they couldn't have been happier. It was a dream come true for these two free-spirited, but very close, mother and daughter. Nadia posted on Facebook on the 26th of March, 2017, "Hi kids, long time no see. Don't get used to it though. This is just a really quick visit to let y'all know we're moving." That's right. A new home has been found, and Mike, Peyton Medley, and I are moving in together. Boise, here we come.
Well, folks, here's my new backyard. Kind of liking this just a little bit. Still a little bit of fence to build here. Actually, a lot. Dogs are the only thing that's grazing now. But that will change. This is where the chickens live. Can't even see the house because of all the trees. Yeah, baby. We're loving it.
It was in early June 2017 that friends and family of both Nadia and Peyton stopped hearing from them. Nadia, she was supposed to collect some horses, their horses, you know, to bring to the house in Caldwell. They were keeping them with their friends till they got new fences done in the house. Well, she never, you know, they had arranged a date. Nadia would come over, get the horses, and she, never showed. Peyton, a teenage girl, all kids, always on their phones, what? Well, she wasn't online or responding to anything. You know, at first, kind of friends and family would think, you know, oh, they moved into a new place. Maybe they got no internet there, no reception. Phones died, you know, XYZ. But after a couple of days, that seems less and less likely. And so calls were made to the Caldwell police, asking them to do a welfare check, you know, to that new house they had just moved into. This was on the 19th of June, 2017. Nadia, Peyton, or even Mike himself hadn't been heard from in over a week. The last time anyone heard from him was around the 8th of June. And so the police arrived, knocking on the door to no answer. No sign of the dogs or the animals they had. It was dead quiet out there. It was hot. It was stifling. You know, a blazing summer's day. But as the officers, they walked around the property, they felt there was a presence there other than the oppressive summer heat. A smell. A gruesome smell underneath it all. And it was coming from this shed, this small shed out back. A shed that was swarming with flies. Police, they opened it up, and inside was a tarp. Underneath that tarp were bodies. Tree bodies. Tree female bodies. It was Nadia, it was Peyton, and a third woman. Middle-aged, but identity unknown. And all three of these women had been shot in the head. The tree dogs had been killed also, and animals that were inside the house, cats and a snake, they too were dead, having been, you know, locked inside this house for at least, you know, 11 days. But there was no sign of Mike Bullinger. The bodies, they looked like they had been there for at least 10 days, which is, well, you know, that matches up with from when they were last heard from on the 8th to when they were discovered on the 19th. And they were unrecognizable. A week and a half during some long, hot summer days, you can imagine. Each one, though, had a gunshot wound to the head. They each had been, you know, one by one executed. So they knew they had Nadia and young Peyton. But who's this other woman? Who the fuck was she? And where the hell was Mike? It took 11 days before the third woman could be identified. And she was identified as one Cheryl Baker. Now this is where the fun begins, my friends. Cheryl Baker was the wife of a Gerald Michael Bullinger. Mike Bullinger. Cheryl was 56 years of age and she had been married to Mike since 2010. Cheryl was also the co-owner of that house that Nadia and Peyton had just moved into. Now, to state the obvious, Cheryl, she had no knowledge of the existence of Nadia and Peyton, and Nadia and Peyton had no knowledge of the existence of Cheryl. Mike, this fucking guy, Mike Bullinger had been living two lives, for quite some time. For years, he'd been living a double life. Cheryl, she was a retired school teacher, and, you know, now she was into crafts, arts, quilts, knitting, sewing, all that kind of stuff. She was also very environmental and very spiritual and all that, which was kind of like, you know, then you've got Nadia, who was like a very militant atheist. But the thing was, when Mike was with Cheryl, he was, oh yeah, spiritual, you know. He had grown up in the LDS church, and now Cheryl, she was like very kind of into Buddhism and all that. And when Mike was with Cheryl, he would be with her. They would do meditations and all that kind of stuff. And when he was with Nadia, though, he'd be like, religion's for sucker. You know, he was like a complete chameleon in that way. So Cheryl and her husband, Mike, given Mike's a bad name, I will not stand for it. They had borrowed money and they had bought that house in Caldwell, and Mike and Cheryl were excited to be moving in. Cheryl, you know, she was going to have a studio for her arts and all that. Mike told Cheryl he was going to head up there early and, you know, get it ready for her, do, you know, odd jobs around the place, fix things up. The kind of regular things you would need to do when you're moving into a new house. While Cheryl, she was at home in their old house in Ogden, packing up their stuff. Little did Cheryl know that Mike was instead moving his girlfriend and her daughter into that house. Now, how he managed to keep, like, these two lives separate for about 2 years? Outstanding. Absolutely outstanding. They never learned of each other. Astounding. They often would post on social media, like the Nadia and Peyton would often post on social media anyway, and Mike, he had no problem being in pictures, you know, on their Facebooks, on their videos. You'd think, like, it'd be in the back of his head, he'd be like, oh, don't take pictures of me in case someone sees it, a friend of a friend of a friend. You never know. Because, get a load of this. So it's weird that he didn't have a problem, you know, being seen with her as her boyfriend. Because, here's another shocker, Cheryl also lived in Ogden. That's the very same town Nadia and Peyton had lived in. They lived 15 minutes away from each other. Ogden, big enough, but not terribly big. Like, it has a population of about 87,000 people. Like, big enough, but, you know, you're gonna bump into people you know, especially on social media. So it's amazing how nobody saw him, you know, with his other life or in pictures, even on social media. I mean, Mike, he had a job as a pilot, so he had excuses to be away for nights and even weeks at a time. But genie Mac, this is mad. So they were none the wiser of each other and would, well, probably would have remained so until. See, Mike, he had been married twice before Cheryl. Both ended in divorce, and both his ex-wives would later call him a lying, manipulative scumbag. They also felt he was selfish, dangerous, and a sociopath, which is a lovely, nice little mix he got going on there. You know what that means? A shit sandwich. So the women in Mike's life, they didn't know anything about his double life. Not until, this is what's believed to have happened, is that around the 8th of June, when, you know, they were last heard from, it's theorized that Cheryl, she drove up, you know, to that house in Caldwell, the one she believed she was moving into with her husband of 10 years. She drove up there thinking Mike was there alone, just pottering around the house. And so she was going there to surprise him. Hey, surprise, look at me. And well, then I'm guessing she opened the door, walked in and went, oh, fuck. She thought he would be there alone, you know, fixing up whatever. So you can imagine Cheryl's pure astonishment when she likely walked into that house and found Nadia, Peyton, and Mike all just living there together, a happy little family. And I'm guessing Mike, he thought of only one way to rectify this situation, a pretty extreme way, I guess is the only way to put it. What Mike, you know, what he thought was going to happen, I have no idea. I mean, he moved his girlfriend and her daughter into the house. His wife was planning on moving into as well. So, I mean, at some point he must have like been thinking, oh shit, you know, fucking clock's running out here. Like, they're going to find out about each other. I can't keep them out of this house at the same time, right? Maybe he'd do some kind of like Benny Hill theme song going on, and he has like Nadia and Peyton in there during the day, and Cheryl comes into the house at night. Who knows what he was thinking? Regardless, no one knows, you know, exactly what happened that day. But Cheryl, Nadia, and Peyton were each executed with a shot to the head. He killed them all to cover up his dark secret, dragged them to this shed out back, covered them up with a tarp, and then what? He went on the run. When the bodies were found, the police investigation, you know, straight up it began, and the hunt was on. It was learned that on the 10th of June, he was, you know, he had breakfast in a local spot in Caldwell, and then later on that day, he was in Ogden, Utah. So the police were at least 10 days behind him when the investigation started. He was driving his own truck, and he drove to where he knew Cheryl's car was being serviced at the time. Cheryl had driven to the house in Caldwell, like in a rental car. So he went, he picked up her car after it was serviced, and he drove away. Then in Ogden, he popped into Cheryl's friends, like their neighbors, knocked on. He was like, hey, have you guys seen Cheryl? I'm just wondering where she is. She's a wink, wink, missing person. So he asked them, hey, have you guys seen her? And then he left again. This time he made a big old drive from Ogden. He went over 200 miles north. That's a 4.5 hour drive to the Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming. See, Mike. Mad about the outdoors, so he was. He was a hiker. And so, that's where he went. He'd been there before. And that is where he vanished into the woods. I mean, I can only imagine he was thinking, this is going to be found sooner or later. Let me go to one of the remotest spots I can think of. I mean, how big is the Grand Teton? Okay, wait. Okay, I probably should have done this before I started recording, but where's the fun of that? This is now a Did You Know podcast, where I just read Wikipedia for an hour. It's great. Okay, so the Grand Teton National Park, it's mega. Now, it's very close. It's like right beside the much more well-known Yellowstone, but equally beautiful, you know? Very easy to get lost in. In fact, get a load of this. A fellow Irishman, a 27-year-old Keane McLaughlin, he was last seen in the Grand Teton National Park. There, he just disappeared. Keane, he'd been living in Wyoming. He worked as a ski instructor. He was very fit, very outdoorsy. And he was in the national park on the 8th of June, 2021. He was hiking in the Lupine Meadows Trail of the park. And then he just disappeared. Searches have been done. His family went from Ireland to the park. Searched for him. What happened to him? No one knows. And that is where Mike Bullinger went on the 11th of June. He, like Keen, has never been seen since. Cheryl's car was found on the 12th of July. Like, by the time the police realized where Mike had gone, the car had been found by the staff at the national park. As I said, you know, they were at least a week and a half behind him. So the staffers say, yeah, this car, it's been here. We don't know what's the deal with it. And it was parked near the northeast entrance. But Mike, there was no clues at the car. Absolutely no sign. He was gone. He was just gone with the wind. Vanished into the national park. So what you got here is, so he went into the park, into the wild, right? And he is still hiding in the woods to this day, which I doubt it. B, he died of exposure in the woods, which is fairly likely. Or C, he went in and he just killed himself. Or, I mean, the other option is he entered the park, he wanted the police to lose his trail in the park, and then he exited elsewhere. Maybe he found, you know, another woman he could bullshit his way through. Now, as I said, Mike, he was experienced in the outdoors. He was a hiker. But people, you know, who would later report sightings of him, you know, when the police, this became obviously a major case, they would say they saw a guy they thought looked like Mike. But when they saw him, they said he wasn't wearing the proper hiking gear. He didn't have water. He didn't have a backpack. He didn't look like he was prepared for the area he was in. You know what I mean? That's one thing they would all say. He was not a young man, and he didn't look like he was ready for a big hike in a national park. But the thing is, many searches were done. Dogs, helicopters, whirlybirds, you know, infrared searches. You name it, and all came up with diddly squat. Like, the search is right, what they found. They found Sasquatch. They found the skunk ape. They found the goblins that are responsible for all these missing people in national parks. What they did not find is Mike Bullinger. So either, you know, he's dead in the park and nothing of him has ever been found, and it's a big park, so that could very well be likely. But you would think that they would have at least found something, like a shoe, a piece of his shirt, a bone. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of animals there. Like, you got wolves, coyotes, bears. So one thing, like, the authorities, they were like, okay, he's lost in the park. There's a good chance he's dead. What could help is the animals. If he's dead and his remains are there, you know, you got all these carnivores who are going to start chowing down. And then if they start eating him, you know, his everything will get spread around. Which would increase, you know, the likelihood of you finding him, as he's kind of in many places. But no, there's nothing of him. What more think, what a lot of people think, is that he did escape the park. He went in there to lose their trail, and then he left somehow through another entrance. I mean, he did have 10 days lead, and that, you know, today, in 2023, he is still out there. He has a new identity. But he's manipulated someone else, another poor woman, into giving him shelter. Like Jackie, his very first wife, would say, he's a sociopath. And what's one thing we know about sociopaths is they have no problem killing other people, but they rarely, very rarely will do that to themselves. As I said, follow-up searches done, many of them, and found nothing. No signs of Mike. You know, maybe he's still in the park. Maybe he's become some kind of caveman. Maybe he's watching you right now, if you're in the Grand Teton National Park and listening to this at this very moment. The chances of which are very slim. But who knows what became of Mike Bullinger. Now, my friends, here is the second tale I have for you. This is a tale of an honest-to-God serial killer who used the national parks across up and down the eastern seaboard of America as his very own hunting ground. How many deaths is he responsible for? Unknown. But likely a shitload. So let's start with one. Let's talk about Meredith Emerson. Meredith Emerson grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. After graduating high school, she went on to the University of Georgia, graduating in 2005 with a bachelor's degree in Le Français. Man, she actually won an award. She was so good at speaking French. Like, I guess it's like a fluency. Can French people try it for that? If I was a French person, I would just lie and then win the award myself. There you go. So our story, it begins on January 1st, New Year's Day, 2008, and a 24-year-old Meredith, she was living in Buford, Georgia, and she decided that New Year's Day to go for a hike with her dog, Ella, on Blood Mountain. That's in the Chattahoochee National Forest. Now, I don't know about you, dear person listening to this, you're my best friend, but Blood Mountain? Really? Like, seriously? Do you want to go hiking on Blood Mountain? Not really, no. Could I change it to, like, Big Titty Mountain, then? Yeah, like, if the Blood Mountain wouldn't keep you away from there, maybe what happened to Meredith will. Now, Meredith lived in Buford, just north of Atlanta, and Blood Mountain is just a little norther. It's about an hour's drive for Meredith. And so she was heading out with her dog, her beautiful dog, Ella. Nice, lovely New Year's Day walk. She left a message on the chalkboard in her apartment for her roommate, saying basically, you know, hey, taking Ella hiking, hope you had fun. Presumably her roommate was at a New Year's party the night before. I should be a detective. Like, this is Sherlock Holmes deduction from your boy right here. Now, Meredith, she never returned from this hike. The next day, when she was a no-show at work, her friends, her boyfriend, they started to become concerned. She'd just gone out for a walk, you know, in a national park not far away. And what happened? So then they began to ask around, anybody seen her, anybody heard from her? No. Her roommate? No, she never came back. Eventually, they made the trip up to that park, and they stumbled across her car parked at Blood Mountain. But no Meredith or Ella. They then alerted the police that this could possibly and likely be serious. But it would end up being a lot more serious than they had imagined. I mean, first off, you know, your thought is maybe she's out there with the dog. She got in some kind of accident. She tripped. She fell. It's winter. It's in a national park. There might not be a lot of people around. She fell down a ravine. God only knows, right? Wrong. The local sheriff's office began with a search of the area, right? And after scratching their heads and finding jack shit, they alerted the Georgia Bureau of Investigations to give them a hand. And the search widened, but there was no sign of Meredith or Ella in the park whatsoever. Didn't look like this was an accident. It looked like this could have been something else. With the reports of a missing woman and her dog also missing on Blood Mountain growing, you know, authorities started handing out posters, you know, on the TV, getting the word out. The police and the authorities were contacted by a man named Bill Clausen. See, Bill, he'd been there on New Year's Day on Blood Mountain with a friend of his. They had been hiking together on that day. And he told the police that himself and another hiker, when they were there that day, they had seen some disturbing clues on the side of the mountain that afternoon. He told the police that while him and his friend, while they were walking the trail, they came across, just kind of strewn around the ground, what looked to them to be like the scene of a fight or some kind of struggle, like something had happened here. Like, water bottles, a dog leash, sunglasses, a baton were just strewn across the ground. Like, this didn't look like trash. It just looked like, you know, something had happened here. The hiker Bill Clausen was with, he had Not long before finding all of this shit strewn across the ground, he had seen an elderly, toothless man with a baton and a dog walking near a young woman who was also with her dog. So he had likely seen Meredith and Ella walking along, but then some old gummy guy with his dog walking near them. So then when they're at the scene, they find all this shit strewn across on the ground. They can see, like, in the woods, you know, and this is, you know, this is January, so it wasn't heavily, you know, there wasn't lots of leaves, it was pretty barren, but they could see, like, hiding, you know, kind of behind the branches and trunks of the trees there, an old man looking at them, like, peeking out, you know, from behind a trunk, watching them, as if he was waiting for them to leave. Seriously, like a creep. They felt, Bill and his friend, they felt very, very weird about this. They started getting really creeped out. Eventually, they lost track of this guy, and they picked up all the items they found on the ground, and they left them at a local store. They left it at that. I mean, fair play, they thought this wasn't trash, but we also, I guess, can't leave it here. So, they just left. They kind of just forgot about it. Whatever. But then they saw the reports of missing Meredith, and they told the police what they had seen that day. Now, the police had a persona of interest owner. Who was that creepy, toothless bastard who's hiding out in the woods with his dog, who may have been the last person to see and talk to Meredith Emerson and poor Ella? On January the 4th, by the way, just to say, Ella the dog, she was found almost 60 miles away. She was found and she was safe. But what happened to Meredith? So the police, they continued, you know, they had a person of interest. They had a description and they put this out on the radio, on the television. And this reached another person. Another person just watching TV, saw it on the news. A guy named John Tabor. And he, from the description, from the location, had a good idea of who they were talking about. What the police were saying, who their person of interest was, it fit the bill of a person he knew. A man named Gary Hilton. Gary had worked for John for about 10 years as a part of Insulated Wall Systems. It's a house siding business. You need better insulation in your walls, call John. And John, he was able to give the police more information about Gary, including his car registration. So after John told all this to police, he's like, I think I know who your person of interest is. Here's everything I know about him. John himself got a ring from Gary. Gary was calling John asking for money. Gary asked John to leave the money at a business John owned. Here, just leave the money there, I'll pick it up. Do a drop off. The police, they got there, they waited for Gary, they set up a sting, but Gary never showed. Then, on the morning of January 4th, which is the same day Ella the dog was found, and now, by now, Meredith has been missing for 3 days, a lawn car truck got stuck in a stream near where Gary was camped. Gary, he lived out of his van, and he was itinerant. He was a drifter. So then the driver of this lawn car approached Gary. He's like, hey, listen, man, could you, you know, use your van? Help me get out of the stream. As he approached Gary's van, Gary's, oh, no, you know, don't come closer. Rushed out to him as if to keep him away from the van. The driver then said, hey, listen, okay, if you're not going to help me, I'm going to call the cops. Gary said, okay, well, see you later. Brum, brum, brum. He fucking raced out of there. Later on, that very same day, January the 4th, a 911 call was made to the police.
Okay, 911, what's the exact location?
I have the person of interest in that missing woman case is at this Chevron gas station on Ashford Dunwoody.
Chevron gas station in Ashford Dunwoody?
Yeah.
You said the van is there?
The van is here. The dog is the red dog, and I saw the man's face, and I've been watching the news, and I know it's him. He's got a green long sleeve sweatshirt, and he's wearing a hat, and he's emptying all this stuff out of his van. I can go take him down if you want.
No, sir, stay right there.
Okay.
The police, they arrived quickly, and they were able to get Gary before he could bleach out his van. And inside, they found Meredith Emerson's blood. Gary was then arrested.
In other words, on Blood Mountain, it's a good place to hunt because it's the most used day hiking trail in the state of Georgia. But it's a bad place to hunt in that you
collide with a lot of people.
So the way you would do it, so the way you would do it would be to lurk in a blind, so to speak, off the trail, observe with binoculars and lurk. But I didn't do that either because I like to hide. So a bunch of people saw me, and then it was a mistake of picking up. Yeah. Because as you said, she almost whipped my ass. You said, I bet that 120-pound girl almost whipped your ass. She almost whipped my ass. She damn sure did. I lost control of both of them, both the knife and the bat.
What happened was that it seems that Meredith, she met Gary Hilton, you know, while out on the trail, and they just, you know, struck up conversation while walking together. Gary was using the fact they both had dogs to like lure her into a false sense of security. Hey, look, I got a dog. You know, guys who, I guess, who have pets to seem automatically more trustworthy. Then Gary, he attacked her just out of nowhere with a knife. Now Meredith, fair play to her, she fought back. She fought for her life, but
it was not my. I mean, I'm better than that. I am, but I found out she was a fucking black belt. Not my finest hour.
He was eventually able to overpower her when he took out a police baton he also had and hit her enough. So Gary, he took her, he dragged her back to his van, and for nearly 72 hours he kept her in his van, driving from town to town to town, trying to take money out of her bank account, withdraw money. But every time they would go to an ATM, she would give him the wrong PIN. She was fair play to her, like she'd give him the wrong PIN. And then, I guess, having enough, he brought her back out to the woods where he bludgeoned her to death, and he cut her head off. He let the dog go. And after his arrest, Gary Hilton, I guess figuring the game was up, he told the police a lot more about what he'd been up to over the years, which was serial killing, namely. But he's really annoying, by the way. He's like an uncle who won't shut up. I mean, they're in the interrogation room, and I guess, you know, they're pretty eager to hear him telling the story of, like, what he'd been up to over the many, many years and all the killing he had done. But I imagine kind of after a while, they were just like, oh, please.
Celebrity. That's what it was. A celebrity. Celebrity. Eurosport. Yeah, nice car. Those cars.
Shup, shup. Gary Hilton was born on November 26th, 1946, in Atlanta. He was, I guess, you know, kind of killy, from a young age. See, when he was 13 years of age, he shot his stepfather, who he thought had taken away his mother. Now, the stepfather didn't press charges against the 13-year-old Gary, but Gary was sent to a mental institution. And at age 17, he joined the army, which was in 1964. And he was sent to West Germany. Wow, you know, what a guy to have with military training and with a rifle, fresh out of a mental institution, who had already attempted to murder his stepdad. I feel safer already. He later said, you know, he started hearing voices, and he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and hospitalized. He was given an honorable discharge, and he left the US Army in 1967. Gary would later get married three times, in fact, but divorce each one in turn. No marriage lasted longer than 2 years. He did. Gotta give it to him. He's what we like to call a content creator, right? In 1995, he helped make a movie. See, Samuel Rayl was an attorney. It was actually, at the time, Gary Hilton's attorney for various misdemeanors, small crimes that Gary would get involved with. But Samuel Rayl, he was like, you know, I don't want to be an attorney. Attorney, you know, I got my... I said, Hollywood is where Samuel wanted to be. He was an attorney turned film producer. And Samuel Rayl wanted to make a movie about a serial killer. This was in 1995. And remember, kind of in the 90s, like, thrillers were all the rage. You know, you had, like, Silence of the Lambs, Seven, The Fugitive. Like, that was all the rage back then. Samuel later said that it was Gary's idea to make a movie about a serial killer who held women captive in the woods. Sounds familiar.
Thanks, Kelly. And thanks to you all. This is great. It never ceases to amaze me what people are capable of achieving when given the proper motivation. I like to think, for my part, that I provide that motivation, that I provide that motivation, that I provide that motivation.
Deadly Run was released in 1995, and it went straight to home video because it was absolute dog shit. The summary, seriously, if you want to watch it, you can just Google it. It's on Vimeo. I'd spare yourself. But the summary goes, respected and very wealthy Atlanta GA area realtor Bobby Wilson has a wife, son, and daughter, but does some things unknown to them. He has a cabin on a rural tract 200 miles to the north, where he often flies his airplane carrying abducted, minimally attached females, who he then releases as game and fatally hunts. A girlfriend of a victim convinces a cop to help close in on Bobby. Bobby. Bobby, as in short for Robert, as in Robert Hansen. This is literally the Robert Hansen story. You know, the same Robert Hansen who, in the 70s, would pick up women around Anchorage, Alaska. He would pick up sex workers specifically. He would take them back to his place. He would sexually assault them. And then he would fly them to a remote location. Like he had his own pilot's license. He had his own plane. He would fly these women to a remote location in Alaska. He would let them go. And then he would begin hunting them. It's believed Robert Hansen did this to approximately 20 women. So, I mean, he kind of just like took a story from reality, but yeah, whatever. Anyway, Gary Hilton loved the outdoors. He loved hiking with his dog and he loved killing people. Some people, you know, they love golf. For others, painting. For others, surfing. For Gaza, killing. One of Gary Hilton's first possible, though unconfirmed, I mean, God only knows how long he was doing this before he got caught. His first possible victim was in 1998. Jason Knapp, a student at Clemson University, disappeared at Table Rock State Park, South Carolina. Gary was actually interviewed about this after his arrest, but he said he didn't have anything to do with it, and the investigators believed him. Though where he was when Jason disappeared remains unaccounted for, and Jason, he's never been found. In December 2005, 26-year-old Rosanna Miliani disappeared. She was last seen in a general store in Bryson City, North Carolina, with an older man. They told the cashier they were going camping on the Appalachian Trail, and the cashier said Rosanna looked nervous. Years later, the cashier would tell the police he thought he saw her with Gary Hilton. By the way, like, obviously this is a podcast, so you can't see what he looks like. He looks scary. He's like, so in the booking photo they have of him here, he's like an older man with a gray beard, like balding on top, but it's his eyes that are really, really creepy. Like, he's really cruel, almost snake-like eyes. He does look like a scary bastard, I will say that. And you can see in the pictures since he's been imprisoned, he just got scarier looking, if I'm gonna be honest with you. In October 2007, John and Irene Bryant met Gary while out hiking in the Pisgah National Forest in North Carolina. They just ran into him, and Gary didn't hesitate for a second. Gary murdered Irene. Her body was found days later, and then kidnapped her husband, John Bryant, forcing him to withdraw money from ATMs. This is the exact same story as Meredith Emerson. Then he took John out to the woods and shot him in the head. In December 2007, so less than a month before Meredith Emerson was killed on New Year's Day 2008, Cheryl Dunlap, a nurse at Florida State University, she disappeared while out in the Apalachicola National Forest, northern Florida. After she failed to show up for work, a search began, and authorities were able to get an image of a man using, once again, her ATM card to withdraw money. In the picture now they had of this guy, it's kind of creepy looking. Like, he's wearing a buttoned-up blue shirt, like a black bucket hat, you know, kind of those fisherman's hat, but black. And he's got a mask over his face. Like, the mask is, like, kind of from The Purge or something, or maybe it's, like, one of those kind of V for Vendetta mask, but it's real creepy looking. Cheryl's body was found 2 weeks after she went missing. Both her hands and head had been removed. 5 days after Cheryl went missing, the body, or rather body part, of Michael Lewis were found in the Tomoka State Park on Florida's eastern coast. It's near Daytona Beach. his head was never found. This is another, unconfirmed victim of Gary. He never confessed, but it's very possible. And so, quite the life Gary had. He had a great time on Our Dime, but he would get life. So, kind of, I don't think that kind of evens out when he's taken so many lives, but, I mean, what can you do? On January 30th, 2008, Gary Hilton pled guilty to the murder of Meredith Emerson. Now, the death penalty was taken off the table if he led them to Meredith's body, which he did. She'd been killed on the 4th of January, which was the same day Gary Hilton was arrested. He was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 30 years. At that time, he was 62 years of age, so the possibility of parole in 30 years, you know, he's going to be his nice, it's a life sentence. It may as well be a life sentence for Gary. He's probably taking supplements, as many vitamin supplements as he can. Oh God, I got to make it. Especially not when, during the subsequent investigations of all these other people I mentioned, he would be further sentenced. In 2011, Gary was tried for Cheryl Dunlap's murder and sentenced to death. In 2012, Gary pleaded guilty to the kidnapping and murder of the Bryans, for which he was sentenced to life in prison. And you'd think, you know, once he's got like a life in prison with the possibility of parole in 30 years and a sentence to death, that would be the end of it. But no, not quite, which do I say? Good. Sentence this asshole as many times as you possibly can. Well, Gary, he wasn't having that. He was supposed to stand before a judge in Tallahassee requesting a new trial on the basis of inadequate counsel, he said. But they were not having that, and all of Gary Hilton's appeals have been denied. He is on death row, where he remains to this day. He's now 76 years of age, looking even creepier. So we got four confirmed victims of Gary Hilton, but it seems unlikely he would become a serial killer so late in life. Like, I think a lot of those unconfirmed disappearances that he may or may not have been related to, I think he's related to. But I also think there could be a hell of a lot more out there. It kind of goes back to what I said at the intro. There's something spooky about national parks. People like Gary Hilton are probably responsible for that. Scary shit. And I mean, Mike Bullinger, well, not strictly a serial killer who stalked people in national parks like Gary Hilton did. I mean, his story is just so wild and insane. And the fact that he disappeared in a national park, never to be seen again. I mean, come on, I'm leaving him in there. He's a national park serial killer in my book. Just try not to think about it, you know, next time you're out in the woods, you'll be fine. Probably. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this old podcast, my friends, folks. Hope it was a good one. You know, if you want to listen to some more of the That Chapter podcast, check out the other episodes, you know, you can. Or you can also go onto YouTube and check out the That Chapter channel, where it's a lot of these stories. Actually, both of these stories I've told on the YouTube channel, but I got, you know, the footage and the videos and all that. So look forward to that and check it out if you want. Also, can I ask you, please, you know, if you wouldn't mind, if you could leave like a review, some positive stars, many stars would be amazingly comfortable if you do. I promise that I will mentally send you a big kiss like Professor X. But until the next one, which will be in a couple of days, take care of each other. Take care of yourselves, because I love you. Mike out.